We want to thank the Poetry and Poetics Colloquium for bringing the group together, bringing Harriet and Erica to the campus. We want to thank the Krieger Wolf Fund and the Alice Kaplan Center for the Humanities for allowing us to have this event. Okay, now I go into the scary stuff. These two folks have done some of the most wonderful things with poetry and with the community, and I really don't know where to begin. So, first off, sort of welcome Harriet to Chilly, Illinois, as she calls it. And it's not cheap cargo. Well, maybe it is cheap cargo. But those are the things that happen to words in her book, Sleeping with the Dictionary. Harriet was born in Florence, Alabama. Don't believe the Christianography in there, in the Sleeping with the Dictionary, because she was born in Alhambra, according to the book. But it's not Alhambra, it's Alabama. It's not alligator, it's Alabama. So Harriet Mullen was born in Florence, Alabama, and she was raised in Fort Worth, Texas. She's earned degrees in English and literature at the University of Texas, Austin, University of California, Santa Cruz. And her books include Tree Tall Woman, Trimming Sperm Kit, Muse and Drudge, and Sleeping with the Dictionary. And there's been a collection, Recyclopedia, that came out in 2006. Her work is driven by sort of an obsession with wordplay, illusion, and popular cliché. It's centered in the larger tradition of African-American writing, with particular emphasis on the representation of black women. Michael Palmer has noted that the reading Mullen's work is a bit like hearing a new musical instrument for the first time, playing against the prevalent social construction of reality. She's also played with some of the, also read and been influenced by some very important musicians. She's got a little point. She talks about playing with Douglas Ewart. As a matter of fact, one of her poems was inspired by Douglas. And she says, when she first read it, she recognized the back and forthness in it and wondered if there was a kind of collaboration with someone else in there, and thought it was a way to playfully begin making fun of hipsters. Such a neat progress went through working with the name of the program begins with. And she wrote this poem at home, and she sent it to Douglas Ewart, confessing how nervous she had been at performing with him. It was rather nerve-wracking to try to read along with his playing, and didn't seem as if there had been that he was there as her musical instrument. It was difficult to know how I should read the work in the context. I didn't want his music to function as my background. One of the things about Harriet's work is the background is everything, it seems. The words are there, we know them, we know where they are in the dictionary. And what she does is she moves them maybe a page over. And we have all new words, all new dictionary, and a different kind of love for what we're reading, and a different kind of attention we're pulled into having when we read Harriet's work. So I wanted to just introduce Harriet and as one of my heroes. And then I want to next introduce the both of these fine ladies, and then they can come up when they're ready. Erica Hunt was born in Manhattan, but she left Manhattan. She attended the University of Vermont, and then she went out to San Francisco, a BA in English from San Francisco State University. But while she was there, doing her time in the Bay Area in the late 70s and 80s, she took an active part in the poetry scene, particularly the group called the Language Poets, who held readings at the Grand Piano, a coffee house on Haight Street. She read as part of the series, and when Steve Laveau with Steve Laveau on the 21st of 1979. In 81, Erica moved back to New York City, carrying with her energy and taste for public talks and social gatherings about poetry, so endemic to the San Francisco area. From 1985 to 1999, she served as a senior program officer and donor advisor to the New World Foundation, a national foundation supporting social justice in New York City. She talks about her work. She says, poetry makes a path out of ordinary language, contesting the ordinary claims about the real. Ordinary language is frequently instrumental, instructional, direct, prescriptive, and remunerative. The language of enlistment and persuasion. But it is in the non-instructional language of poetry, in which the lapidary, the spare, the mysterious, the destructive, the molecular, the masculine, the anagramic, and so on is what you get as the beauty of her work, and so on. It provides a previously undetected links to thinking and acting on alternatives and to building a just society. Erica is an expert on economics issues, and she's been a senior program officer with the New World Foundation before joining the 21st Century Foundation. In 1998, she began new work in the field of black philanthropy. She took a small group during her tenure, the 21st Century Fund, she sought to strengthen black giving and community-based philanthropy through donor education, grant giving, and donor-advised fundraising. She moved under her supervision. The 21st Century Fund has grown from a volunteer organization to a premier national $8 million public foundation for serving the black community. If you can write it, and you can say it, and you can do it, I don't know what else there is to do. Mm-hmm. So these two ladies, I think I should be very glad. I think you should be very glad to receive. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Well, we're going to take turns.
You mean two?
Two and two.
Okay, all right. So we'll be mixing it up, apparently. Yes, all right, we did discuss this. So I'm very grateful to be here. Thank you, Ed, for the introduction. I think we last worked together in Berkeley.
Yeah.
And Erica and I had the pleasure of being in a gathering of poets on her porch last summer. So this is another wonderful reunion. I just met Susanna today. That was great. So very happy to be here. I thought, well, since we're going to mix it up, so I'll start with some work from Recyclopedia. I think, yes. So trimmings was all about what women wear. It was somewhat in dialogue with Gertrude Stein. You know, we talk to people even when they leave the earth. We keep talking back to them. So this was basically kind of a list. I started with all of these lists, and then my friends would say, what about garter belts? I said, do people still wear garter belts? Yeah, when they want to be sexy. You know, they get those Victoria's Secret garter belts. Anyway, so I think that's in here somewhere. I might not read that one. But so here's a little bit of trimmings. Becoming, for a song, a belt becomes such a small waist, snakes around her, wrapping. Add waist to any figure, subtract, divide. Accessories multiply a look. Just the thing, A handy belt suggests embrace, sucks her in. She buckles, smiles, tighter, quick to spot a bulge below the belt. Lips clasped together, old leather, fastened with a little snap, strapped, broke, quick snatch in a clutch, chase the lady with the alligator purse. Green thief, off relief, got into her pocketbook by a hook or crook. Tender white kid, off white tan, snug black leather, second skin fits like a love, an utter, other, uttered, bag of tricks, slight hand preserved, a dainty, a solid color covers, while rubber is protection, tight is tender, softness cured, alive and warm, some animal hides, ghosts wear fingers, delicate wrists. Starving to muffler moans, boa scarfs her up, feathers tickle her nose, kerchief, fichu, gesundheit. Her red and white, white and blue banner manner, her red and white all over black and blue, Hannah's bandana flagging her down in the kitchen with Dinah, with Jemima, someone in the kitchen I know. A little tight, something spiked, tries on a scandal. One of a pair vamps it up with a heel. If the shoe fits, another mule kicking, a fallen archangel loses soul support. A light, white, disgraceful sugar looks pink, wears an air, pale compared to shadows standing by, to plump recliner, naked truth lies. Behind her shadow wears her color, arms full of flowers. A rosy charm is pink, and she is ink. The mistress wears no petticoat or leaves, the other in shadow, a large pink dress. In folds of chase petticoats, chupa mirtos, in a red sack with a silk ribbon, hummingbird whose tongue is sweet, charm for love, a captive beat, a flutter, hidden under ruffles, secret heart, a red pouch tied with silk. Of a girl in white, between the lines, in the spaces where nothing is written, her starched petticoats giving him the slip, loose lips a telltale spot where she was kissed and told, who would believe her, lying still between the sheets, the pillowcases, the dirty laundry laundered, pillow talk show on a leather couch, slips in and out of dreams, without permission, slips out the door, a name adores a Freudian slip. Step into gathered floral, sashay and flounce out. At length, skirts sweep her furbelow, or slit tight, gourd wrapped, young shirt tail tucked. Cowgirl, hips suede, leather fringe, skirts a border, a stiff fine crinoline, straight seams hemmed or binding, warm hands, felt skirt, an issue of blood, she pleated. Heart sleeves dart, bleeds whiter white, softened with wear, among blousy buxom bosomed, give us this, blowing, blissful, open, oh most immaculate, bleached blouse, bless any starched, loosening blossom. Of what material softness folds to hold her, under when over, inside or out, where air is, makes a difference in motion, living here or walking, taking off, putting on her flimsy garment, holes breathe and swallow, openings, hem, sleeve, borders on edges where skin stops or begins, fancy trim, sew buttons on, but they are slow to open flowers, imagine the color, loose skirt, a petal, a pocket for your hand. My dress falls over my head. A shadow overtakes me. Girl, pinked, beribboned, alternate virgin at first blush, starched petticoat besmirched, stiff with blood, a little worse for wear. In feathers, in bananas, in her own skin, intelligent body attached to a gaze, stripped down model posing for a savage art, brought color to a primitive stage. I think I'll go to the end. What a little moonlight inside her pink silvery is softness condensing a glaze to repair a blister. Itches sit and silken, growing dearer to the wearer. Who would wear a necklace of tears? Inside her moonlight lining, tears were shed. Smooth tears, bitter water. A salted wound produced a pearl. A mother's luster manufactured a colored other. Pearl had a mother who cried. So, see, let me just read a little bit of Muse and Drudge. I'll read a little bit from the middle. In Dahomey, the royal umbrella, roof, sky, tree, dome, heads up the procession of saints, balling the jack back home. Framed in her snake relief decorated doorway, bordered with zigzag deer legs, the notched beam is a stepladder, dried millet a sign of hospitality. This art is fast disappearing. Indigenous pigments learned from their mothers, earth from the river, fingers and hands. Men harnessed mules, rode hard, put away wet, on the brine sea, unwed men toss and sweat. Go ahead and sing the blues, then ask for forgiveness. You can't do everything and still be saved. Update old records, tune around the verses, fast time and swing out, head set in a groove. Felt some good sounds, but didn't have the time. Sing it in my voice, put words in like I want them. Noise in the market. My Mustang done slowed down. Tore up bad now. Put a ruination on it. Wine's wicked, wine's divine. Pickle drunk down to the rind. Depression ham ain't got no bone. Watermelons rampant and blazing. Island named Daughter. Gullah buck backwater. She swim, she fish. Here it be fresh. Cassava, yucca, taro, dasheen, spicy yam, okra, vinegary greens, guava, salt cod, catfish, ackee, fat meats, greasy, that's too easy. Not to be outdone, she put the big pot in the little pot. When you get food this good, you know the cook stuck her foot in it. And that would be a good description of a meal at Erica's house.
Okay,
then I'll read food. I'll read food. I've been writing a lot of essays lately, so I said, should I read about food or should I read about death? And Harriet said, read about food. So, let's see. I'll read a little bit about food.
Up to you.
Some sentences in the House of Poetics. Let's see. Oh, here it is. Okay. Well, flavor. Proust began with a madeleine dipped into a cup of tea. I suppose I can begin with a pig's foot savored late at night, way past bedtime, almost midnight, brought to a table in a white china bowl. The pig's foot would be tender, taupe, and topped with a bay leaf. steam would curl from a half inch or so of broth, its beguiling fragrance signaling doneness, the extraordinary transformation of toes, gristle, and skin into silky communion. The pig is dead. Long live the pig. What was this midnight meal called? It was called supper. We called it supper. On the table, there were bottles of vinegared peppers, tiny and yellow and green, and cherry bomb Tabasco to be used judiciously. The vinyl red and white checked tablecloth protected the formica table from spills. Beer for my father, hot Lipton tea for my mother, and us kids. We sat down, all of us, for an unsteady and ephemeral moment, co-conspirators, breathing in a meal together. My father cooked pig's feet. Cooking food for these casual suppers was his signature pleasure, but though he cooked food vivid in memory, my arc of remembering encompasses father and mother both. She helped by calling out ingredients he might have missed. A backseat driver in a house dress at the kitchen table. Garlic powder, paprika, pick a pepper, bay leaf, allspice. They were for me then as gods at the creation, though they were emphatic monotheists, Trinitarians, well-stocked with a host of orthodox beliefs, education, proper language, hard work, merit, equal rights. They believed in the kind of modernity that emphasized progress and change. You move out of the village into the larger world of people and ideas without concern for losing identity or roots, for how can you lose what can never be taken away or even given away? The foods we ate at our casual suppers were savored traditions, fiery, toothy, and slow-cooked interpretations of the past. The pig's feet were ready when the meat almost fell off the bone. The knuckles were loose, yielding a blend of fat, gristle, and bones ready to be sucked. A dash of hot sauce or vinegar and the fat dissolved. I like the way when I ate my portion with my hands, pig's feet are almost exclusively a finger food, it made my fingers stick together. The natural gelatin in any animal's hooves reverts to an adhesive chemistry. I would play, letting my fingers seal into an almost unbreakable bond, with no worry about what alchemy might be unfolding in my digestive tract. My parents were the wizards. I mean, I'm thinking about it these days, right? My parents were the wizards of meals made from the discarded parts of animals, neck bones, gizzards, liver, and tripe. They drew the line at chitlins, at least other people's chitlins. They would make their own once or twice a year, only gradually abandoning this dish as the difficulty of locating a reliable butcher who you could trust with a delicate task of proper handling, and the chore of soaking them overnight, changing the water frequently, grew more burdensome every year. Every family is part of a village, a larger culture, in my case, Black American and Caribbean culture, and every family is its own culture, a microculture. In our microculture, my father used to use the walk home from the main post office in Manhattan to our home in the housing projects to hunt and gather for our family meals. He walked up 9th Avenue, then dense with butchers, sausage makers, bakeries, fishmongers, produce sellers of a dozen or more nationalities. The shops were open from early in the morning and were living proof of the phrase, the city never sleeps. They never closed their doors but hummed with fluorescent light and white-coated hive activity all night. The street was a spoke emanating from the arterial hub connecting Penn Station, Port Authority, and the shipyards to the west by the river where stuff and food in all stages of processing and manufacture traveled along the capillaries of the old West Side Highway, connecting it to the whole rest of the country. It never slept on 9th Avenue. The shops were open to send and receive. The streets were a warren of stacked crates, clots of produce and fish and double parked vans and hand trucks, gurneys, push carts. It was bedlam and men. These were not sedate shops with a curated display, a singular specimen of this or that, artfully matched or accessorized on a green doily, bathed in spotlight, as extraordinary in the street window. No, these shops sold specialties among profusion, a dense display of cheese, or pork, or live poultry, a shop selling one kind of thing and lots of it, as if they would never run out of it. In the Salomaria, The man, white suited behind the counter, surrounded by logs of preserved sausage, would take my father's order and then hand me a big hunk of bologna or whatever he was slicing for my father. Next door, the fresh pork butcher stood around the shop, outside the shop, beside a pile of pig's heads, masses of sausage. Hopefully there are no vegetarians here. Masses of sausage, intestines in big plastic buckets, sweetbreads, and offal. Next door to that store, in a storefront devoted to beef, sides of beef curtained the window as men ferried all manner of cows and steers. Inside, the floor was covered with sawdust and sections of richly marbled beef carcasses carved by electric saw crowded the counters. And next door to that, abundant and enormous fish, mackerel, snapper, flounder, lay flat and supine beside eels and gape-mouthed monkfish pinned down on thrones of ice beside bushel baskets of blue crabs in mad gladiator chaos. Here's how it stands, haloed in memory. My father is at home here in the tumult of the market. He greets the cheesemonger first as he removes his hat. He gestures at me, his daughter, and points with his chin at his selection. Blue cheese. My father indicates a white wheel of cheese pockmarked with blue scratches, as if a small indigo animal was encased and trying to break its way out. We get a wedge in smooth white paper wrapped in one deft gesture. At the cheese store, men stand by as discreet as waiters at an exclusive club at their stations by gigantic wheels of Swiss, Roquefort, and Stilton. It is part of a routine, mundane and dizzying. A poem. Fool for love. I cannot claim rigor or musk or blindfold or hormone-heated hunger. I cannot claim my bulb is out or loss in the binary, phantomed, limbed calamity. I cannot claim missed destiny or a hole in the cards, singularity, dull. I cannot claim habit or empty chair, haunting or disestablished echo. I cannot claim arousal by flame, sputtering fire, or drowning in crackle. I cannot claim amnesia, plastic bag pudding abandoned by the curb, or other voiceless discards testifying in a damp of coffee grinds. I cannot claim a perfect enthusiasm, gritted risk, or high drama flowering toe to toe and eye to eye. I cannot claim my grain is porous and sunder, ready to soak in heaven and earth a ton of mud. I cannot claim my double won't appear. She throws tantrums and galoshes. She follows thumbprints. She blows things out of proportion. She won't use her name. So this is from a series called Peace Logic. It's one of my favorite poems to read out loud. I have a cold, but I'm going to try to read it out loud. Invisible hands trade down the block around the world, down the food chain, from forward to back, to escape the air-grabbing heat. The crop fails. The monsoon comes in June, a fluke of the weather, a storm of flowers, whipped into a rain that claims the last village. The residents head out to the city to make more money. They never make the money they seek. Instead, they make keychains, sneakers, baseball gloves, flame-proof nightwear, transmissions, stereos, computer chips, Gap jeans, rugby polo shirts, dolls with the features of Norte Americanos, or slave girls, or Indian princesses, living their lives in legend, unlike their own, except for an unlocatable middle. They leave just in time. The chain continues unbroken to unwind the thing after the thing, a line of never broken nouns. If it breaks, we fix it quick so the chain can never be broken, even if it shouts out a chorus set to shovel. The rocks never seem to disappear but become dust, a dust that lasts from morning to morning, chained to a logic we are doomed to follow. Invisible hands. They rice the peas, they spice the rice, they circle the turns, they turn on the presses, they raise the letters, they letter the spaces, they address the edges, they bang into one another. Invisible hands mask the connections. Invisible hands milk the spill, shift the ink, jump the rope, rip the chute, lay the rail, tune the tear, eye the glass, bat the wing, bat the lash, brown the tan, fiddle the sticks, ride the herd, read the horde, hear the roar, read the dim, damp the time, rhyme the orange. Invisible hands toast the storage. Invisible hands carry the thread, thread the vowel, stall the call, pour the molds, powder the walls, dent the bins, stamp the bills, core the questions, comma the nouns, time the charts, corner the squares, square the curves, loosen the jaws, spill the beans, bell the cats, feed the beasts. It's years before a family will follow off the edge of this ramp into the putative new life where the past has vanished and the present is all time charts marked invisibly. Only visibly hot in a red dark of selective vision, in plain sight and out of sight, one hand tries to clap the other, as in the phrase, give me some skin. The slap of palms, right hand to right hand, empty. No weapon there, see, we come in peace. We come out of the hypnotic circle that orbits and holds us in constant bind of stick em up and lap dancing, out of rigged destiny, across the violent border of property and oblivion, where hands once again can be detected in the bric-a-brac of the world.
Okay, so this is my last round, yes?
Yes.
Okay. So I'm going to read a little from Sleeping with the Dictionary. Let's see. I'll start with all she wrote. Forgive me. I'm no good at this. I can't write back. I never read your letter. I can't say I got your note. I haven't had the strength to open the envelope. The mail stacks up by the door. Your hand's illegible. Your postcards were defaced. Wash your wet hair. Any document you meant to send has yet to reach me. The untied parcel service never delivered. I regret to say I'm unable to reply to your unexpressed desires. I didn't get the book you sent. By the way, my computer was stolen. Now I'm unable to process words. I suffer from aphasia. I've just returned from Kenya and Korea. Didn't you get a card from me yet? What can I tell you? I forgot what I was going to say. I still can't find a pen that works. And then I broke my pencil. You know how scarce paper is these days. I admit, I haven't been recycling. I never have time to read the Times. I'm out of shopping bags to put the old news in. I didn't get to the market. I meant to clip the coupons. I haven't read the mail yet. I can't get out the door to work. So I called in sick. I went to bed with writer's cramp. If I couldn't get back to writing, I thought I'd catch up on my reading. Then Oprah came on with a fabulous author plugging her best-selling book. So, I think Oprah's still reading, yes?
Yes, she is.
Okay. I remember going into bookstores and seeing books with a little sign that said, The Gospel According to Oprah, you know, where Oprah recommends this. Hey, that was, she was selling books. Okay, so this poem is called X-Ray Vision. And now, you know, when Oprah stopped reading, that's when the bookstores all went out of business. How was that? So this is X-ray vision.
Oh,
you X-ray vision. What?
Did
you?
Which page?
Oh, I'm sorry. That's at the end. Page 83. That's one of the last ones. It's in alphabetical order. You don't need X-ray vision to see through me. No superpowers required to penetrate my defense. Without listening to your mother's rant, you can tell that my motives are transparent. A sturdy intuition could give you the strong impression that my logic is flimsy. Before the flat lady sang the first note of the book, you knew that my story was thin. And, you know, we recently lost another poet, Jane Cortez, and there's a poem in here that I wrote in some way inspired by her. And, you know, it was a collaboration between me and the ethnocentric software of my computer, you know, because it would always correct her last name, you know, to Cortex, from Cortez to Cortex. And these words actually are related, you know. So thanks to that, I got Fancy Cortex from Jane Cortez, because she's no plain Jane. All right. I'm using my plain brain to imagine her fancy cortex, as if my lowly mollusk could wear so exalted a mantle as her pontifex pallium, as if the knots and tangles of my twisted psyche could mesh with her intricate synaptic network of condensed neural convolutions, as if my simple chalk could fossilize the memory of her monumental reefs of cauliflural coral, as if my shallow unschooled shoals could reckon the calculus of her conch's brainwave tsunami, as if the pedestrian software of my mundane explorer could map as rounded colonies the terra incognita of her undiscovered hemispheres, as if the speculative diagnosis of my imaging technology could chart the direction of her intuitive intellect, as if the inquisitive iris of my galaxy orbiting telescope could see as far as her vision, as if the trained nostrils of my narco bloodhound could sniff out what she senses in the wind, as if my duty-free bottle of jerk sauce could simulate the fire ant picante that inflames her tongue of rage, as if the gray matter of my dim bulb could be enlightened by the brilliance of her burning watts, as if her divergent universification might fancy the microcosm of my prosaic mind. And I also wanted to read Resistance is Fertile. Sometimes I have to think, what did I call that poem? Resistance is Fertile, because, you know, I usually don't have a television. So I didn't have a TV when I moved to LA, and I hadn't had one for years. And then I realized in order to understand my undergraduates, I had to have TV. So I got a TV, and I quickly, they showed Star Trek probably 5 times a day, some version of Star Trek. So I got caught up on a lot of Star Trek, which was kind of far, far, far in the background of this poem. But you remember the Borgs, right? Some of y'all can remember the Borgs. Anyway. This system needs your moral fiber like a bowl of X brand flakes. If your kind cannot be assimilated to make spare parts for Borg wars, your resistance challenges the ant farm to adapt. You might think the system's tone deaf, but our software's immune. You are the virus that keeps it in tune. We are the tolerant host, which makes you the guest worker colony of E. coli. The chitlins inside the chitlins. Catching hits off our perfect pitch, your contrafeits a false note passed through the phony caca. We call you irresponsible, say you're indigestible, and it's undeniably true, it's tough to swallow you. Your data resisted analysis, but if you are not consumed, your flawed construction only proves that we are perfection cubed. Did you need to read the label on Olean to know the SOS goes out when the chip's going down? To Cuisinart our metaphors once again, let's just say that Dracula's liquid protein diet could use some roughage to help with his next smooth move. A bloodsucker's got to worry about irregularity. So pollsters press the pulse, take specimens of the blood count. Pundits poo-poo as Law and Order candidate Bruce Wayne leaves his potty to go on a turd pootie ticket. Libertarian runs on a bowel movement platform. The result will be a better grade of guano piling up in the bat cave. Our constipation requires frequent amendments to feed the tree of liberty. Can you dig it? Can you dig it, man? You're digging it with a shovel. When you're all pooped out, we're just breaking a second wind. So let's see. I will read, "We are not responsible. We are not responsible for your lost or stolen relatives. We cannot guarantee your safety if you disobey our instructions. We do not endorse the causes or claims of people begging for handouts. We reserve the right to refuse service to anyone. Your ticket does not guarantee that we will honor your reservations. In order to facilitate our procedures, please limit your carrying on. Before taking off, please extinguish all smoldering resentments. If you cannot understand English, you will be moved out of the way. In the event of a loss, you better look out for yourself. Your insurance was canceled because we can no longer handle your frightful claims. Our handlers lost your luggage and we are unable to find the key to your legal case. You were detained for interrogation because you fit the profile. You are not presumed to be innocent if the police have reason to suspect you are carrying a concealed wallet. It's not our fault you were born wearing a gang color. It is not our obligation to inform you of your rights. Step aside, please, while our officer inspects your bad attitude. You have no rights that we are bound to respect. Please remain calm, or we can't be held responsible for what happens to you." So, on that happy note, I will just read the... Are you kidding? Okay. All right. So, all right, then I will read a couple more. Let's see here. I'll read the title poem, "Sleeping with the Dictionary." I beg to dicker with my silver-tongued companion, whose lips are ready to read my shining gloss. A versatile partner, conversant and well-versed in the verbal art. The dictionary is not averse to the solitary habits of the curiously wide-awake reader. In the dark night's insomnia, the book is a stimulating sedative, awakening my tired imagination to the hypnagogic trance of language. Retiring to the canopy of the bedroom, turning on the bedside light, taking the big dictionary to bed, clutching the unabridged bulk, heavy with the weight of all the meanings between these covers, smoothing the thin sheets thick with accented syllables. All are exercises in the conscious regimen of dreamers who toss words on their tongues while turning illuminated pages. To go through all these motions and procedures, groping in the dark for an alluring word, is the poet's nocturnal mission. Aroused by myriad possibilities, we try out the most perverse positions in the practice of our nightly act, the penetration of the denotative body of the work. Any exit from the logic of language might be an entry in a symptomatic dictionary. The alphabetical order of this ample block of knowledge might render a dense lexicon of lucid hallucinations. Beside the bed, a pad lies open to record the meanderings of migratory words. In the rapid eye movement of the poet's night vision, this dictum can be decoded like the secret acrostic of a lover's name. So let's see. I will read "Dim Lady." Okay. This poem took me all the way to London. I got to actually see the Globe Theater because of this poem. Yes, which started out as an exercise I did with my students at UCLA. We all used the same source and we all wrote different poems. So, you know, people say, well, put that Uli Poe stuff, you know, that N plus 7 or S plus 7. Won't you all end up with the same poem? Well, do we all have the same dictionary? Are we all starting with the same source? Do we all just count to 7? What if you count to 6 or 8, you know, or 5 or 3? You know, what if you count backwards? So, no, we don't all write the same poem. And sometimes we just say, I don't like those words in that dictionary. I'm just going to make up my own word, which is what I did sometimes. So, okay, dim lady. My honey bunches peepers are nothing like neon. Today's special at Red Lobster is redder than her kisser. If liquid paper is white, her racks are institutional beige. If her mop were slinkies, dishwater slinkies would grow on her noggin. I have seen tablecloths in Shakey's pizza parlors, red and white, but no such picnic colors do I see in her mug. And in some minty fresh mouthwashes, there is more sweetness than in the garlic breeze my main squeeze wheezes. I love to hear her rap, yet I'm aware that Muzak has a hipper beat. I don't know any Marilyn Monroes. My ball and chain is plain from head to toe. And yet, by gosh, my scrumptious Twinkie has as much sex appeal for me as any lanky model or platinum movie idol who's hyped beyond belief. So we did those with Shakespeare sonnets, and we did those with Neruda sonnets. Mm-hmm. And everybody wrote different poems, even from starting from the same. Okay, so I will read two more. Okay, so this is denigration. This is one I read a lot. Okay, so, you know, not everybody knows that someone got fired for using a word that sounds like another word. Mm-hmm. This person was a broadcaster, I think, or was in some kind of public high-profile job and used this word that sounds like another word, but they actually are not etymologically related, these two words. So anyway, it stimulated me to write this poem. I think Elizabeth Alexander wrote a different poem about the same occasion, and her poem went in another direction, but so this is mine. Did we surprise our teachers who had niggling doubts about the picayune brains of small black children who reminded them of clean pickaninnies on a box of laundry soap? How muddy is the Mississippi compared to the third longest river of the darkest continent? In the land of the Igbo, the Hausa, and the Yoruba, what is the price per barrel of nigrescence? Those slaves who were wealth, survived on niggardly provisions. Should inheritors of wealth fault the poor enigma for lacking a dictionary? Does the mayor demand a recount of every bullet, or does City Hall simply neglect the black alderman's district? If I disagree with your beliefs, do you chalk it up to my negligible powers of discrimination, supposing I'm just trifling and not worth considering? Does my niggling concern with trivial matters negate my ability to negotiate in good faith? Though maroons who were unruly Africans, not loose horses or lazy sailors, were called renegades in Spanish, will I turn any blacker if I renege on this deal? And so I will end with Wino Rhino. So you all may not have particularly, you know, people who live on your campus who don't have any other connection to your campus, but they come because there are bathrooms, you know, and we get these bulletins from time to time. We found this person sleeping in the building overnight, and be on the lookout for this person, you know. So there are certain characters that I pass on my way to and from work every day. This is called Wino Rhino. For no specific reason, I have become one of the city's unicorns. No rare species, but one in range of danger. No mythical animal, but a common creature of urban legend. No potent stallion woven into poetry and song, just the tough, horny beast you may observe roaming at large in our habitat. I'm known to adventurers whose drive-by safari is this circumscribed wilderness. Denatured photographers like to shoot me, tipping the bottle. Capture me, snorting dust. Mount on the wall my horn of empties that spilled the grape's blood. My flesh crawls with itchy insects. My heart quivers as arrows on street maps target me for urban removal. You can see that my hair's stiffened and my skin's thick, but the bravest camera can't document what my armor hides. How I know you so well. Why I know my own strength. Why when I charge you with my rags, I won't overturn your sporty Jeep. Thank you.
Okay. So a few minutes. Makes me think of a poem. Trying to be spontaneous here. This is my first book, Rock of History. Corner of the eye. She must be someone's missing person, the unread portion. She sits on the stoop tearing pages out of 18-month-old penthouse magazines that someone has stacked for recycling. The gray sky is an emulsion of humidity and promised rain. She's oblivious beneath her umbrella. She's eating French toast and a large orange juice that someone walked out without paying for. She's a victim of a conspiracy of her teeth that keeps her away from the food that she loves, raw carrots, corn, apples, raisins. She is forced to order omelets and French toast. Sometimes she offers to sweep the floors afterwards or rinse the windows of their daily ashes and to defer to the empty plate that poverty and the times demand. It depends. When it's busy, her strategies are good currency, the currency of goodwill. She's wearing a skirt and pants, and it's cold, and she's between sexes just now. She's wearing shoes that don't fit her feet, like old felt hats at the end of her legs. One of the definitions of being a person is that another person is talking to you. The person is particular, unlike that diffuse group of people you don't spend time with who are all pronouns. This person, however, is the source of certain facts, but not the facts that she ever speaks out loud. This person you become accustomed to, her buckle, her pins, our pins, her ankles, her sore ankles, our sore ankles, her limp, our limp, your person or her person, it doesn't matter in the dwindling middle ground. More politics. My country consists, this is a new one, my country consists of airports and high-calorie business dinners. My country makes me afraid, but well-dressed, if I choose to be. My country affords me endless opportunities to dress up, seductively, rustically, aristocratically, with complete respect for my anonymity. My country is the projected envy of half the world, the paradise of relative security. My country is not my country, but has been under house arrest by a right-wing coup of resource monopolists and greedy militarists. I am part of a country struggling to get enough rest, to sleep through the war of the dispossessed. I am part of a country that has outgrown lynching and now builds its prisons from the inside out. I am part of a country that dims sight and smell and sound is cushioned in soft furnishings and blankets. I am part of a country that carries on through social media, a lively exchange of kittens. Calico and palomino cats for hours each day, soft bandages of fur, the scratches removed from the lens. I am part of a country where five fingers of oil mining media defense, lock it up in a fist, whether you like it or not. A fist in a velvet glove from which you cannot make a break, no matter how much you are in the know. In fact, being in the know is being held against you. You are marked for replacement. I am part of a country that chooses to eat its young rather than give up its SUVs and guns. The news breaks. It's all up into pieces. Stilted jigsaw. Words like me, we, them, you. Cluster covered by weeds. Some fun. You know, sometimes you have to have a tantrum. Okay. I had a young friend when he was seven or so. Told his mom, "Look, Mom, I can run through the playground with my eyes closed." Running through the playground with my eyes shut. Step out barefoot, walk the fault lines, improvise phone tones, deliberate, speak Battle Creek, speak in many syllables, speak with your hands, speak with the left hand only to the left-handed dentist. No false advertising to fake paint, to package color apart from its thinness. No fame to claim, just this thin tissue, walking on thin tissue, the lightest paper that ever gentled rapid breath. Each breath completes me. Breath after breath, a fresh start compounded. Step out barefooted, left-footed. Sun and breeze, run so fast the wind rumples me. But I am fierce, a born thrill seeker. I am the girl who played Man from U.N.C.L.E. for hours and play it still, now, undercover, running along the brink. I love a layered plot, levels of glass and commotion, temperatures at the melting point and their asymmetric drips. I love those bangs coming from inside the pot, unpredictable sightings on the coast of civilized forms of agreement. The idea of inside, out, and backwards, talking to the feeling in mid-spill. A car that only goes in reverse, all the gears round out, have become specks of noise. All bets are off, left hanging in the air, left in incomplete sentences. I am running, I am running, I am running, but I do not know what I will run into, pleasure or concrete. Finally, as I say, I've been writing a lot of sentences lately. Let me make sure I have all the sentences here. Yes. There are mornings when I cannot sleep. I begin to tally the virtues of my bed and think, the deficiencies far outnumber the comfort. The sheet doesn't stay on the mattress and it lies bunched beneath my cheek. The mattress retains far more warmth in a manner that makes me fling off covers to expose my legs and arms and bottom just to cool things down. And the dip, the mysterious channel that bifurcates the bed lengthwise, trapping either me or my partner in a slide into the valley, no matter how much I try to cling to the mattress edge, cool and unbunched. There is also the matter of mattress buttons. They have too much feeling and conspicuously disturb sleep. And the pillow folds one's neck uncompromisingly close to a crick of week-long proportions. One will be forced to turn the whole body like an ocean-going vessel, slowly and inflexibly, just to see who called from behind. This bed seems less friendly, don't you think? Less capacious than I remember. What happened to its length? What happened to its breadth? Why do I feel so curled all the time? How could one person, my partner, take up so much room? He is lying diagonally. Miraculously, the 80-inch bed cannot contain a 6-foot-2 height. I mean, at 5'5", I am lying down in the shape of the letter B. In this bed, gravity has conspired to work with peculiar force and made my flesh collect in impossible packages so that my ankles crack, my wrists snap, my neck and back beg for a beneficent rack to stretch me out and unroll me from this letter B. From the bed, I see a light where there should be no light. Is this how long ago the accounts of nighttime visitors Is this how long ago the accounts of nighttime visitors, the angels and aliens, were drawn from the color of a bad night? I've been coffee, never again. I think of the late night dinner, never again. They multiply the bad points of the bed, the burps and the hisses, its inability to stay straight. I bump into my beloved and he into me as I turn. I don't mean to. He grabs my hand as he sleeps and he says, what a nice hand it is. At least something is working about this bed, that we might overcome the day's indigestion and find a simple happiness to hold on to. The bed has its knocks, or it knocks me about all night. Only in the morning I discover the sock I thought I lost. It was the bed that devoured it and now expels it along with other entombed clothing. Is there a term for what the bed does to me? Is it felonious assault? It aims to make me an Ahab in my own bed, where other nights I no sooner hit the sheets than I am drawn pleasantly into dreams I remember mainly in their final scenes, the part where the narrative arc inexplicably yet triumphant in a muddled way. For instance, the man has come to fix the roof. We know him and trust him. He carries musical rubber bands, and his work with clouds is well known. Our roof is saved. Hip, hip, hooray. Now for coffee. The same bed, which is capable of delivering such bliss, such perfect resolution, has turned insensible, literally incapable of flight. It lacks all cloud training. I am now its prisoner, and once I make the break with pen in hand, what seemed murk and spite in that swamp of a bed has turned into just the nudge I needed to write. Thank you.
Questions.
And don't feel trapped.
Yeah, right.
If you don't have any questions, we're here and then we're leaving.
That's it.
But then you're coming back.
This is the first time I've been in Evanston.
Me too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And?
Really? <No. laughs> It's been a while since I've actually seen snow, too. Mm-hmm. Actually, I saw a little bit of snow last spring in Sweden. Mm-hmm. So I seem to have to go out of the country to see snow, usually.
It's been a while for us, too.
That's why I left Ithaca. Mm-hmm. I saw a hand.
Okay, good.
Erica, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about your sort of shift toward from poetry to what you're calling sentences, and mm-hmm. and sort of how those different, we might call, genres relate together for you.
Yeah. Two things come to mind. First, I recently decided to go back to school, and I got a master's degree in nonfiction, end of it, which was, you know, why did I do that? Because I've been a poet for a long time. And I found the adjustment a little bit difficult because you have to say so much. Sense, you know, poetry, you don't have to say everything. It's a virtue to leave things out, hold something back, and mystery is part, you know, mystery and what's erased and sort of reduction, concision, is what is a virtue in poetry. And in nonfiction, I found that it's not. I want you to write and write. And I say, isn't it obvious? But I also was drawn to doing it because I was talking to Harriet and to Ed and Susanna about a question I've been asked after readings. Are your poems about real things? Someone asked me. And I go, well, yeah. I mean, sometimes they're imagined, but they really happened. I really imagined them. I really had that train of thought. I really, often, poetry is a way of tracing thought, mm-hmm. right? And nonfiction is just another way of doing that, maybe filling in a little bit of the blanks around that.
Poetry leaps more. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Hope that's helpful. Yes. Yes?
Okay, this feels like a risky question. Sort of.
Yeah.
but I would love to hear both of you actually. tradition of African-American poetry, which I think wrongfully has been seen as, you know, sort of, maybe committed to a particular kind of representativeness, like committed to more, the lyric in a particular way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's not actually a really great account, but because I think both of you have been committed to aesthetics in different ways, I'd love to just talk about your relationship to that constellation. Thanks.
Yeah, we've been talking a lot about narrative and representation lately. I think that's a part of anyone's tradition, but it's a part. It's not necessarily the whole. And also, some of these stories are repeated so often that we almost don't listen anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think one of the further virtues of poetry or any kind of art there's a certain kind of art that is consoling, which I often go to art for consolation or for a kind of reminder of things that I think I know. And then sometimes I go to art to push me into my zone of discomfort and to stretch and to also see some things or hear some things differently. Things that we get used to and we don't pay that much attention to because we think we already know. What's your sense of that?
Yeah, I would pick up on that about stretching past what we think we already know. And I believe in the utopian possibilities of art, which is that, you know, we have to rehearse the world we want somewhere. And we can rehearse that in the relatively unpoliced spaces of art.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and that's where we can make free and have license to imagine possibilities that we may not be able to imagine within as well, within a formal or within sort of traditional or conventional spaces. Not that it is impossible, but rather that sometimes you have to kind of step beyond what you're told is, oh, there you are on solid ground, there's the lyric, you know,
mm-hmm.
and maybe take a step back and deal with found materials or what's been told to you as that's not the main event, that's a side character. Well, but maybe the side character is really what's interesting,
mm-hmm.
you know. Maybe that's where the heat really is.
I think there's also a virtue to when you say something that could be found or random. To me, that's a form of otherness. And I think, for me, there's a great virtue in trying to find or create a space for otherness in the work so that I don't have to feel that it's always my voice, my ideas, my thoughts, that there are openings that allow this other to enter. And that other can be the reader, it can be some other text that I'm working with, it can be the environment in which I'm writing, it could be, you know, sometimes I'm writing while the radio is on, and something in the radio will get into the poem, or it'll alter the direction of what I'm writing. So to me, that's a way of surprising myself and writing something that is more than what I could actually think of writing. You know, that there's
mm-hmm.
something that's not me that's part of the process of writing. And to me, that friction between what I intend and what may be a kind of serendipitous juxtaposition of my thought with something from outside.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that happens even in what we think of as more conventional poetry. I mean, people kind of smooth it over. There's a kind of poetry that traditionally, those interruptions are smoothed over so that we don't feel them.
We don't feel them as interruptions. Mm-hmm. But there are twists and turns, even in a very traditional poem, that can't necessarily be rationally accounted for.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think partly what we're doing, at least what I think I'm doing, is sometimes allowing that to show that there was an interruption, that there was an other that collided with my thought.
So this is for Professor Mullen. I wanted to ask, because we read your work last quarter, I want to know from your perspective, do you call it sperm kit or super?
Oh, yes. I think there are at least three things. It was originally, of course, the word supermarket. When you remove letters, it could be pronounced sort of sperm kit or S-perm kit. You know, there's something called an S-perm.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, because like they really classify our hair as either Z or S,
mm-hmm.
you know, so the really supposedly like real African hair is Z and looser curl is S.
Yeah.
So people who have Z want to get S, right? That's interesting. That's always interesting to me. Like, okay, we moved down the alphabet, we moved, you know, somewhere. So then I was just thinking about all the weird things that are actually sold side by side. You know, it used to be, I think they don't do this anymore, but used to be able to like get rat poison in the supermarket, you know, so where you buy your formula and your black eyed peas and your tomatoes and then rat poison, you know. So, and you might even, I think you can buy now pregnancy kits in supermarkets. So just the kind of crazy juxtaposition. And then the letters that are removed are U-A-R-E, kind of like you are what you eat or what you shop.
Mm-hmm.
So there are different ways to read that. And you know, we're always encountering signs where letters have fallen off or neon that's burnt out, you know. So I do those games all the time with license plates or signs, you know, like, yeah, there was a play called Hot Ill Baltimore. You know, from
mm-hmm.
hotel
Baltimore.
Right. So people have been doing mm-hmm. this for a long time. I didn't invent that. Right.
What's your mind?
Yes. This is too intimate a question, but
you can ask away. We don't have to
answer.
Dictionaries that you've known and loved. We had Christian Buck was here a little over a year ago, and he tells a wonderful story about the dictionary that he used to make Eunoia.
Yeah.
I don't mean to literalize the dictionary in your work at all, but I'm curious if you do have a sort of strong affective relationships to any particular dictionaries and what those might be.
I have different dictionaries. Like I have slang dictionary. I have African American slang. I have American and British slang. I have a feminist dictionary, I have etymological dictionaries, I have some other crazy, I have the thesaurus and the synonym finder, because sometimes you just want to find a word alphabetically. So, and I love the American heritage. I mean, I think I wrote about that in somewhere. But, you know, that they had a usage panel. So it was created through a democratic process.
Mm-hmm.
And the original American Heritage Dictionary, the one that I have, there's other subsequent editions of it, but the one I have, Bontemps and Arna Bontemps and
mm-hmm.
Langston Hughes and Gloria Steinem were among the editorial consultants.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I loved about it was that you could look up something and they would give you the vote of the usage panel. Like 40% of the usage panel thought this is correct, and 52% thought this other was correct. And I thought, that is American.
Yeah.
You know, this is our American heritage. And then there's this great little essay at the beginning about the Indo-European origins of the language, and you know, that to me that was very entertaining. Also liked the fact that when I opened the dictionary and I just happened to turn to, I think the word discus, and there was a picture of an African American woman with a discus in her hand.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of sold me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I was in high school, I had a dictionary made for high school students. When I opened this dictionary, And somehow the word, my eye fell on black Muslims. They were defined as a hate group in this dictionary. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I knew people who were Muslims, mm-hmm. you know, and you know, I know that they had, especially at that time, pretty far-fetched ideology. But it was a religion, and that's part of America too, is that you have the right to start your own crazy religion, you know, and believe whatever the heck you want to believe. You
Mormons.
Know? Yeah, whoever, you know, you can decide who the devils are, you know, and who the angels are. That was their right. So, but to see it defined in a dictionary as a hate group, that was when I really understood, oh, this word is contested, you know. These meanings don't fall from heaven.
Okay, well, let me just announce that tomorrow at noon in the same room we'll have a workshop with Harriet and Erica, and you're all invited to come. They'll be talking about their work and about the Black avant-garde and, you know, this and that, and we'll serve lunch. So please, please do join us, and thank you.
Thank you.